At 7 o'clock on the evening of the 5th of June, tanks of the 16th Cavalry Regiment of the Indian Army started moving up to the Golden Temple complex. They passed the Jallianwala Bagh, the enclosed garden where General Dyer massacred nearly 400 people. And that massacre dealt a mortal blow to Britain's hopes of continuing to rule India, and was one of the most powerful inspirations of the freedom movement. When Mrs. Gandhi was told that Operation Blue Star had started, she must have wondered whether it would provide the decisive inspiration for the Sikh independence movement, a movement which at that time had very little support outside Bindranwale's entourage and small groups of Sikhs living in Britain, Canada, and the United States. Major General Brown had addressed his men before he ordered them to enter the Golden Temple complex. Major General Brahe had addressed his men before he ordered them to enter the Golden Temple complex. He was commanding a mixed bag of troops, representative of the widespread recruiting pattern of the modern Indian Army, which has broken with the British tradition of limiting recruitment to certain martial castes. There were Dogras and Kumanis from the foothills of the Himalayas, India's northern border. There were Rajputs, the desert warriors from Rajasthan. There were Madrasis from Tamil Nadu, one of the tribes of central India, and also some Sikhs. Major General Brahe told his men that entering the Golden Temple complex was a last resort, that they had to do it to stop the country being held ransom any longer. Bindranwale was identified as the enemy, and the attacking force was told that he had seized control of the temple. Every man was told that he must not fire at either of the shrines inside the temple complex, the Golden Temple and the Akal Takht, without direct orders. It was almost 30 years to the day since Brahe had joined the Maratha Light Infantry as a lieutenant. He had fought in the Bangladesh War under Lieutenant General Jagjit Singh Arora, the Sikh general who was to be one of the most outspoken critics of Operation Blue Star. Brahe had been decorated for gallantry. He had also held an important staff post in the Defence Ministry and was now commanding one of the crack infantry divisions, the 9th. Brahe was a stylish soldier with curly grey hair emerging from under the beret he wore, pulled well down over his right ear. Brahe's superior officer was Lieutenant General Krishna Swami Sundarji, the General Officer Commanding in Chief Western Command. He had joined the Maha Regiment, a new regiment designed to bring a non-martial caste into the army. During the 1965 war with Pakistan, Sundarji commanded a battalion, and during the Bangladesh War, he was a brigadier on the staff in the Eastern Sector. Sundarji had also commanded the College of Combat at Mau, one of the most important training institutes of the Indian Army. He had a reputation as a strategist and was in the running for the number one job, the chief of the army staff. Sundarji asked his chief staff officer, Lieutenant General Ranjit Singh Dayal, to draw up the plans for Operation Blue Star. Brahe was a Sikh, he still wore a turban. Dyer was also an infantry soldier, having served in the 1st Battalion, the Parachute Regiment, which was to spearhead the attack on the Golden Temple complex. During the 1965 war with Pakistan, Dyer became the legend by capturing a pass which had previously been thought to be impregnable, and blocking off one of the most important routes from Pakistan-controlled Kashmir into the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir. A frontal assault was impossible, and so Lieutenant General Dyle climbed up the mountain towering over the Haji Pir Pass and came down on top of the Pakistanis. He described the operation himself. I then sought permission with my commanding officer to capture the Haji Pir Pass. Permission was granted and then began the march forward. The enemy fired from two directions. I sent one platoon to silence the enemy guns. I and the rest of my men continued to advance and reached Hyderabad Nala by 7 p.m. From then on, it was bad going. The pass for them was a 4,000-foot steep climb. It was rising heavily. The ground was slushy. I left the beaten track and took another route. In fact, it was not a route at all. It was a steep climb. Despite the heavy odds, we reached the road leading to the pass at 4:30 a.m. on August the 28th. I decided to give my men carrying guns and batteries the much needed rest. After 2 hours, we again started, and at 8 a.m., we reached a bund, an embankment near the pass. Leaving some men there to keep the enemy engaged, along with the rest of the party, I climbed another hill feature, and from there rolled down and stormed the enemy position at the pass. The enemy fled in confusion, leaving their guns. By 10:30 a.m., we were in complete control of the pass. When he briefed the press after Operation Blue Star, Lieutenant General Sundarji described the orders the government had given him. I was told to flush out the extremists from the Golden Temple with no damage, if possible, to the Harmandir-Sahib Golden Temple, and as little as possible damage to the Akal Takht. I was told to use the bare minimum of force required for achieving this object, and that I was to minimize casualties to both sides. I was to try to prevent internecine fighting between the two major groups which are lodged inside the temple complex, the one that of Jano Singh Bhindranwale, and the second that of Mr. Longawal and his followers. Lieutenant General Dyal told the press the principle of minimum force was to be applied throughout. He described Operation Blue Star as a typical infantry operation. Dyal also stressed that all troops were ordered not to damage the Golden Temple. He was a deeply religious man who had been coming to the Golden Temple to pray. The Lieutenant General told the press that he never doubted that his men would obey their orders not to damage the shrine. As all of you know, the Indian Army is a very religious army. Once the orders are given to them, they follow them to the letter. And once it was told to them not to damage the Golden Temple, I was sure they would obey this. And I'm proud to say that they did until then. Dyal also gave an example of the piety of Indian Army soldiers from his own experience. In 1965, the war with Pakistan, we went into an objective. There we saw some courage crazy. Suddenly the shelling started. One cow got hurt by a shell, and I saw a Jawan soldier pulling out his field dressing and applying it. Lieutenant General Sundarji also stressed the religious aspect of the operation. He said, "We went inside with humility in our hearts and prayers on our lips. We are in the army, hold all places of religion in equal reverence." To achieve his objectives of flushing out the extremists from the Golden Temple complex, doing minimum damage to the shrines, and preventing a battle breaking out in the hostile complex, Dyal drew up a twofold plan. The essence of the plan was to separate the hostel complex from the temple complex, so that the hostel could be evacuated without becoming involved in the main battle. To achieve his prime objective of getting Vindramoli out of the temple complex, Niall had planned commando operations. The commandos were to be supported by infantry. Tanks were only to be used as platforms for machine guns to neutralize fire on troops approaching the Golden Temple complex and to cover the temple exits in case anyone tried to escape. Armored personnel carriers were to be positioned on the road separating the hostels from the temple complex to keep the two potential battlefields apart. The three generals succeeded in achieving only one of their objectives. The Golden Temple complex was clear, but to say that Vindramoli was flushed out would be, to put it mildly, an understatement. He was blasted out of the Atal Tut by the 105mm main armament of Ilyan Vijayanta tanks. In the process, much of the Atal Tut, the shrine which according to the original orders was to suffer as little as possible damage, was reduced to rubble. At the start of the operation, troops had even been forbidden to use automatic weapons against the Atal Tut. The evacuation of the hostel complex was completed, but not without heavy civilian casualties. The first task was the destruction of Major General Sharbik Singh's outer defense. Much of this had been completed in the preliminary fire, when Major General Brar had hoped to frighten Vindramoli into surrender. These defenses included the 17 houses which the police had allowed Vindramoli's followers to occupy in the alleys surrounding the Golden Temple. Some of them were as far as 800 yards away from the complex. These outposts were all in wireless contact with Sharbek Singh's command post in the Akal Tak. The Temple View Hotel outside the temple complex had also been occupied. As its name implies, the cable seeks an excellent vantage point from which to keep watch over the main entrance to the Golden Temple, as well as a clear arc of fire. Next to it was Brahmbhuta Akhara, a large building housing the headquarters of the Sikh sect. This building also commanded the approach to the Golden Temple. Then there were three towers, which had been fortified to make positions from which Vindramoli's men could fire into the Golden Temple complex. Because they stood well above the rest of the buildings, the towers were also excellent observation posts for watching the movement of troops in the narrow alleys surrounding the temple. One of them was a water tower. The other two were 18th century brick watchtowers which resembled minarets. The old towers stood 18 feet high and were near the langar, or dining hall, on whose roof Vindramoli had addressed so many congregations. Major General Barr said that he ordered artillery to blast off the tops of the three towers. However, he decided not to capture the 17 houses, because he didn't have the resources to do so. Firing continued from these houses for days after the Golden Temple complex had been captured. The use of artillery in an area as crowded and densely populated as the old city of Amritsar proved, not surprisingly, to be very costly. Artillery is an area weapon used to kill and suppress fire over a wide area, and is not commonly used against special targets. Severe damage was caused to several bazaars, but Brar had to secure the posts commanding the entrance to the temple and the inside of the temple itself before he could send his soldiers into the historic headquarters of the Sikh religion. It was only when he was convinced approaches of the temple complex working. The Bra ordered the tanks to move into the square in front of the northern entrance to the Golden Temple, known as the Gantagar or Clock Tower entrance. One of the tank commanders said, "As soon as I turned right from Jallianwala, the tick-tick sound of shells landing on my tank. Over the headphones, I got the order to neutralize the fire." According to the lieutenant of the 16th Cavalry, there were 4 tanks and 3 armored cars. He said that Shahbagh Singh appeared to be monitoring their movements, because once the Royal Army was in position, firing from the walls of the temple stopped. The lieutenant reported back to his commanding officer that firing had been neutralized. But as soon as the assault on the temple started, it became clear that Shahbagh Singh's firepower was far from neutralized. Meanwhile, in the narrow alley behind the Ashalpat, those paramilitary commandos who trained on the model of the Golden Temple complex were trying to get into Bindranwala's fortress. That operation was a dismal failure. Some commandos did get onto the roof of the shrine, but they were caught in the crossfire and had to withdraw. For some reason, this part of the operation was not mentioned at all by the generals when they briefed the press after it was all over. It was between 10 and 10:30 in the evening that Major General Bra decided he must launch a frontal attack on the Ashalpat. Commandos from the 1st Battalion, the Pursuit Regiment, wearing black denim, were ordered to run down the steps under the Parikrama, onto the Parikrama or pavement, turn right, and move as quickly as they could round the edge of the sacred tank to the Ashalpat. But as the paratroopers entered the main gateway of the temple, they were mown down. Most of the casualties were caused by Sikhs with light machine guns, who were hiding on either side of the steps leading down to the Parikrama. The few commandos who did get down the steps were driven back by a barrage of fire from the buildings on the south side of the sacred room. In the control room, in a house on the opposite side of the Proctar Square, Major General Bra was waiting anxiously with his 2 superior officers to hear that the commandos had established positions inside the complex. When no report came through, he was heard over the command network saying, "You bastards, why didn't you go in?" The few commandos who survived regrouped in the square outside the temple and reported back to Major General Barr. He reinforced them and ordered them to make another attempt to go in. The commandos were to be followed by the 10th Battalion of the Guards, commanded by a Muslim, Lieutenant Colonel Israr Khan. This battalion had Sikh soldiers in its ranks. The second commando attack managed to neutralize the machine gun posts on either side of the steps and get down onto the Parikrama. They were followed by the guards, who came under withering fire and were not able to make any progress towards their objective, the Ashalpat. Lieutenant Colonel Israr Khan radioed for permission to fire back at the buildings on the other side of the tank. That would have meant that the Golden Temple itself, which is in the middle of the tank, would have been in the line of fire. Bra refused permission. He still believed it would be possible to achieve all his objectives, including preserving the Golden Temple and the Ashalpat intact. But then he started to get messages from the commander of the guards reporting heavy casualties. They had suffered almost 20% casualties without managing to turn the corner of the Parikrama to the western side of the complex where the Ashalpat is situated. The guards were not only being fired at from the northern and western side, Sikhs were also suddenly appeared from manholes in the Parikrama. The guards were fighting for, let off a burst of machine gun fire or throw lethal grenades made in the complex itself and disappear into the passages which run under the temple. These machine gunners have been taught to fire at knee level because Major General Sharbat Singh expected the army to fall towards its objective. But the guards and commandos were not falling, and so many of them received severe leg injuries. Ra then decided on the change of plan. As he said after the battle, "I realized it was difficult for this battalion to progress operations any further, and there was no point in them remaining at the ground floor level. Unless you got on to the first floor and to the rooftops and got it to control the situation, you would continue suffering casualties." So the task given to them was, under all circumstances, to get a lodgment in spite of all the casualties they had suffered. And I must give full credit to the battalion commander, a very dashing young soldier, Lieutenant Colonel Israkar, who rallied his boys together and worked his way up, and did succeed in getting an allotment in this particular area. That allotment enabled the guards to neutralize some of the positions on the south side of the tank, but they were still hampered by the order not to fire in any direction which would endanger either of the historic shrines. In spite of the very heavy firing, some of the commanders did manage to get round that corner of the Parikrama and make their way to the courtyard in front of the Akal Tower. But they fought their way into a lethal trap. The Akal Tower itself was heavily fortified. There were sandbags and brick gun emplacements in its windows and arches, and holes had been made in its sacred bar by firing positions. On either side of the shrine are buildings which overlook the courtyard. They had been fortified too, as had the Toshakhana or temple treasury opposite the Akal Tower, and the houses which overlooked the building from behind. So when the commandos got into the courtyard, bullets rained down on them from all sides. They were driven back, suffering 30% casualties. The courtyard in front of the Akal Tak had been turned, in Major General Brad's words, into a killing ground. To make matters worse, there was no sign of the madrasas who were meant to be entering the Golden Temple complex from the southern side to form the other half of a pincer movement on the Akal. When it became clear that the madrasas had either got bogged down or lost in the narrow alleys, Ra asked his superiors for permission to use troops from another division, the 15th. The infantry from his own division was fully deployed. The guards were inside the temple on the north side. The madrasas were trying to make their way to the eastern entrance, and the commands were clearing a hostile complex. The Bihars had thrown a cordon around the temple. Their main responsibility was to ensure that neither Bindran Bolli nor any of his followers escaped. Sundarji and Dayal agreed to reinforcing the operation, and so two companies of the 7th Garhwal Rifles were put under Brass command. The Garhwals also come from the foothills of the Himalayas, in the state of Uttar Pradesh. Ra ordered them to enter the temple from the southern side and try to relieve the pressure on the guards and the commandos on the northern side. As soon as they entered the southern gate, they came under heavy fire. An officer of the Garhwals said, "They seemed to be firing on us from everywhere. It was impossible to know where to fire back." But the Garhwals did manage to establish a position on the roof of the temple library. Their commanding officer reported this to his brigadier, A.K. Dewan. Dewan was very much a soldier's soldier, always wanting to be in the thick of it. His nickname was surprisingly Chicken. Apparently, he was called Chicken because when he was an officer cadet, He had a very long neck. The British air should have left the fighting inside the complex to the battalion officers, but he could not resist the temptation to join in himself. The lieutenant colonel, commander of the Narwhals, tried to dissuade him, saying that his men were under very heavy fire, but this was an added attraction for the guard. When he got into the temple, he reported to Major General Brahe on the wireless. Brahe, whose temper was wearing a little thin by this time, could be heard over the whole network shouting at Dewan, "What the hell are you doing in there? I'm in command of this operation. You don't move without my orders." Then Brahe calmed down and asked Dewan to stay inside and let him have a sit rep as soon as possible. Dewan realized that it was very unlikely that the guards and the commanders would be able to achieve their objective. But he did reckon that his position on the southern side was fairly secure, and that if he could reinforce it, he might be able to storm the shrine. When he reported this back to Brahe, he was given permission to call up two companies for the 15th Command. By this time, the operation had been in progress for about 2 hours, and Brahe was nowhere near achieving his objective. His short, sharp commando operation had got bogged down. So he decided to allow Dewan to fight his own battle inside the temple complex. Dewan made repeated attempts to storm the Akal. But each time the commands or Garwals turned the corner of the parikrama and ran into the courtyard in front of the Akal Tak, they came under withering fire and had to retreat. Dewan himself was striding up and down the southern side of the parikrama, encouraging his men. But their task was impossible. Although both the northern and the southern sides of the parikrama were by now in control of the army, they had not been able to make any impression on the main fortress and the defences surrounding it, and the four companies had suffered 137 casualties. Of course, they were still hampered by the order not to fire in any direction, which would endanger the Golden Temple. Dewan decided to wait for the Madrasis, who were still trying and then make one last attempt to storm the Akalta. The Madrasis eventually made it at about 3 o'clock in the morning, some 5 hours late. They came into the temple complex through the gate on the hostel side. When they entered, heavy firing was still going on, and it was dark. In the confusion, the Madrasis opened fire on Dewan's troops. The British air shouted, "Don't shoot! I'm the deputy GOC." When that little cock-up, as one officer put it, had been sorted out, Dewan launched his final attack. There was no way anyone could get into that fortress without taking out its defense first. Dewan's repeated charges were as futile as the charge of the Light Brigade, and he now realized it. He got on to wireless and told Brahe that he would have to call up tanks to bombard the Akal Tak. He said, "I can't afford to lose any more men. I can't accept defeat." Brahe later told the press his version of what happened next. "The infantry was in danger of being massacred. Hesitatingly, I had to ask my supporters that I must take a tank in. I cannot allow the infantry now. The infantry just cannot carry on doing the impossible task. I must say that the reaction was instantaneous, and that was due to the fact that both my commanders were sitting barely 15 meters away, as the line of sight is from the scene of action." Sondergren's action was not instantaneous. He first contacted Delhi, where a special operations room had been set up to keep track of the battle. The Deputy Defence Minister, K.P. Singh Deo, a former army officer himself was in charge, assisted by Rajiv Gandhi's most trusted aide, Arun Singh, although not a practicing Sikh, came from one of the Punjab royal families. The army and the government were now faced with a dilemma. Sundarji had always insisted that the operation must be completed by daybreak. Otherwise, his men inside the temple would be sitting ducks for Bindranwale's snipers. There would be no question of withdrawing and trying again the next night, because the news that Bindranwale and Shah Beg Singh forced the Indian army to withdraw would certainly leak out somehow. And that would have disastrous consequences in the villages of Punjab and among Sikhs in the army. The only answer seemed to be tanks. They were the only equipment with the firepower and the accuracy to blast away into Bindranwale's fortress. But tanks meant that the army would fail in one of its tasks, the preservation of Ratan Tha. They also meant the horrifying prospect of one mistake by a gunner seriously damaging the Golden Temple itself. In the end, Delhi agreed that the tanks should be used, and a message was sent back to Lieutenant General Sundarji nearly 2 hours after Chicken Duan had asked for it. In the meanwhile, Major General Brahe had made one more effort to get his men into the aftermath. He called up a Scott 0264 armored personnel carrier. Tanks had to break down the steps leading to the Kralikrama from the hostile side so that the eight-wheeled Polish built APC could get in. The aim was to drive the ABC right up to the Akal Tak, so that the men from the mechanized infantry, one of the newest units of the Indian Army, could get into the fortress under the cover of its wall. But as the armored personnel carrier approached the Akal Tak, it came under fire from 2 Chinese-made rocket-propelled grenade launchers. One of the grenades found its target, and the armored personnel carrier was knocked out. The captain commanding the platoon was wounded. This forced the general to rethink their strategy once again. They had no intelligence reports of Shah Beg Singh having armored piercing weapons at his disposal. Even the tanks, which had by now made their way onto the Parikrama to await government clearance to open fire, were now at risk. Although the maximum armor of the tanks was more than twice as thick as the APC. The tanks had been trying to blind the marksmen in Bindranwale's fortress with their searchlights. As soon as Brahe realized that the army had armor-piercing weapons, he ordered the tank commanders to switch off their searchlights. The tanks had ploughed up the Parikrama, each of whose marble slabs was inscribed with the name of the devotee who had donated it to the temple. The Vijayanta was the army's main battle tank, being an Indian-built version of the Vickers 38-ton tank. When the orders came, they opened up with their main armor. Photographs of the shattered shrine indicate quite clearly that the Vijayanta's 105mm main armaments pumped high-explosive squash-head shells into the Akal Tak. Those shells were designed for use against hard targets, like armor and fortifications. When the shells hit their targets, their heads spread or squash onto the hard surface. Their fuses are arranged to allow a short delay between the impact and the shells ignited, so the shock wave passes through the target and a heavy slab of armor or masonry is forced away from the inside of the armored vehicle or fortification. Lieutenant General Jagjit Singh Arora, who studied the front of the Akal Tak before it was repaired, reckoned that as many as 80 of those lethal shells could be fired into the shrine. The advantage of a tank's main armor is that it fires with pinpoint accuracy. Indian Army officers talk of the Vijayanta's ability to post shells through letterboxes. The effect of this barrage on the Akalpa was devastating. The whole of the front of the sacred shrine was destroyed, leaving hardly a pillar standing. Fires broke out in many of the different rooms, blackening the marble walls and wrecking the delicate decorations dating from Maharaja Ranjit Singh's time. They included marble inlay, plaster and mirror, and filigree partitions. The gold-painted dome of the Akalta was also badly damaged by artillery. At one stage during the night, Major General Brower had ordered his colonel administration to mount a 3.7-inch howl gun on the top of a building behind the shrine and fire at the dome in an attempt to frighten the surrender. Brower explained to his colonel, maybe the noise and the sting would have its effect. The artillery did not scare Bindran Wally's men. But the tank barrage was a different matter. The effect it must have had is impossible to imagine. As shockwave after shockwave rocked the building, the gallant and misguided defenders must have feared it was going to come down on top of them. Deafened by the explosion, they were driven to the back of the building by the flames and falling masonry. Deadly machine gun fire, which had been raining down on the army, stopped. Still, sporadic resistance continued from some of the buildings overlooking the courtyard in front of the Akalta. By now it was light, and Bahar decided it was too dangerous to make the final assault necessary to re-establish control over the shrine from which Bindran Wally and Shah Beg Singh had withstood the Indian Army Act. So Brigadier Dewan was ordered not to follow up the tank attack until darkness fell again. The three generals at the command post knew that they had knocked out Bindran Wally's fortress, but they still faced the agonizing possibility that the Sant himself might have escaped. After the battle, Brower told the press that only one tank had been driven onto the Parikrama, and that it had only fitted its secondary armament, a 7.62mm machine gun. But the damage to the Akalpa tells a different story. There was no machine gun which could have brought down so much masonry, and the shell marks were clearly those of high explosive squash heads. As for the number of tanks involved, other officers, Satish Jacob talked to, said that as many as six were brought into the complex. As one, Vijayanta only carries 44 rounds of main armament ammunition. It is certain that more than one was used. It also seems likely that the gunners fired from more than one position because the Golden Temple itself was in their arc of fire, standing as it does in the middle of the sacred. The battle for the Akalpa was not the only one raging that night. Across the road, running along the eastern side of the Golden Temple complex, another battalion of the command regiment was involved in a second operation that Lieutenant General Sundarji had been ordered to carry out. He had been told by the government to prevent internecine fighting between the two major groups lodged in the temple and the hotel complex. The one of General Singh Bindran Wally, and the second of Mr. Dongal and his followers. To prevent the two groups fighting each other, the generals had decided that the hostel complex housing Lungal and his men must be clear at the same time as the Golden Temple. The first problem was to get into the complex. The iron gates at the top of the public road between the hostels and the temple had been barred. A tank had to break them down. Armored cars were then positioned along that road to separate the two battlefields. and the 9th Commands moved in. They came under fire from the wounds on both sides of the road. But unlike their colleagues inside the temple complex, they managed to fight their way into the buildings they had been ordered to clear. Most of the terrified pilgrims, supporters of the Akali Morcha, and of course the two members of the Akali Trinity, with their staff, were huddled together in two buildings. They were without water because the water tower had been destroyed during the paramilitary operation, and without electricity. Longawal Tora and some of their senior colleagues were in Tora's office on the ground floor of the Teja Singh Samundala Hall. The SGPC secretary, Ban Singh, later described the situation in that building. They cut our electricity and water supplies. It was very hot in the rooms. There was no water. We had only two plastic buckets of water. Longawal had to place two people as guards over the buckets. Many people would squeeze their undershirts to drink their sweat, to quench their thirst. The army entered the Teja Singh at Samundari Hall at about 1 o'clock in the morning. According to one officer, Tora and Longawal were in their vests and underpants. The army said they surrendered. Ban Singh did not accept that statement. He said, "We did not give ourselves up. The army forced its way in and took us prisoners." That's really just a matter of semantics. What is absolutely clear is that Longawal and Tora made no attempt to resist the army. The Akali leaders were kept inside one of their offices. The rest of the people in the building were ordered to come out and sit in a courtyard in the Guru Ram Das Hostel. According to Ban Singh, there were about 250 of them. Some terrorists, seeing the people pouring out of the office and surrendering, threw a grenade at them. Ban Singh explained what happened. Suddenly, there was a big explosion. All hell broke loose. It was pitch dark. People started running back into the van room. I and Abhinashi Singh were sitting next to Gulcharan Singh, the former secretary of the Kali Dal, whom Bindranwale accused of murdering Sodhi. Gulcharan was shot as he tried to run inside. We realized that soldiers were shooting at us. They thought someone from among the crowd had exploded a grenade. But it was probably thrown by extremists on the water tank overlooking the Guru Ram Das Sarai. We ran to Tora's room and told Longawal what was happening. Longawal came out and shouted at the major. He said, "Don't shoot these people. They are not extremists. They are employees of the SGPC." The major then ordered his men to stop shooting. Later in the morning, we counted at least 70 dead bodies in the compound. There were women and children too. The white paper admitted that 70 people, including 30 women and 5 children, died in that. But the government put all the blame on the terrorists, saying nothing about the army firing. According to Ban Singh, the survivors were interned in the courtyard of the Guru Ram Das Hostel until curfew was lifted the next evening. He said they were not given food, drink, or medical aid. Some people, according to the SGPC secretary, drank water which had poured out of the tank the army had blown up and had formed puddles in the courtyard. Karnail Kaur, a young mother and 3 children, who had come with 65 other people from her village to join in Longawal's agitation, said, "When people begged for water, some jawans told them to drink the mixture of blood and urine on the ground." Ban Singh also told the journalist and historian Kushwant Singh that the army did shoot some of the young men they had brought out from the Teja Singh Samundari Hall. He said, "I saw about 35 or 36 Sikhs lined up with their hands raised above their heads, and the major was about to order them to shock. When I asked him for medical help, he got into a rage, tore my turban off my head, and ordered his men to shoot me. I turned back and fled, jumping over bodies of the dead and injured, and saved my life crawling along the walls. I got to the room where Tora and some longer wall were sitting and told them what I had seen. Sada Karnel Singh Naga, who had followed me, also narrated what he had seen, as well as the killing of 35 to 36 young Sikhs by cannon. All of these young men were victims. But not everyone the army rounded up in the Tejas Singh Sundari Hall was innocent. Among those who surrendered was Bindran Wallace's talkative young interpreter, Harminder Singh Sandhu, who was also the General Secretary of the All India Sikh Students Federation. When I had seen him on the day before the army action started, he had boasted every one of Sanji's followers would lay down their lives to save the Golden Temple. But when the time came, Harminder Singh Sandhu surrendered. Inside the Guru Ram Das Hospital, where the rooms were crowded with pilgrims, conditions were reminiscent of the Black Hole in Calcutta. School teacher Rambia Kaur and her husband had locked themselves into room 141 with the 12 children they were looking after. Rambia Kaur said, "We were all huddled together. We didn't know what was happening. The noise was terrifying. We had not been out of the room for more than 24 hours, and we had no food or water. It was a very hot summer night. I told the children that we must be ready to die." The Kamau Regiment also entered the hospital at about 1 o'clock in the morning and ordered everyone to come out. But this was not the end of their ordeal. Rambia Kaur described what happened next. Early on the sixth morning, the army came into the Guru Ram Das Barrack and ordered all those in the rooms to come out. We were taken into the courtyard. The men were separated from the women. We were also divided into old and young women, and so I was separated from the children. But I managed to get back to the old women. When we were sitting there, the army released 150 people from the basement. They were asked why they had not come out earlier. They said the door had been locked from the outside. They were asked to hold up their hands, and then they were shot after 15 minutes. Other young men were told to untie their turbans. They were used to tie their hands behind their backs. The army hit them on the head with the butts of their arms. The people in the basement were Muslims from Bangladesh, who had nothing to do with their Kali agitation. They were non-Bengalis, known as Biharis, who had sided with the Pakistan army during the liberation struggle in 1971 and had been living in refugee camps in Bangladesh for the last 13 years. The Pakistan government had refused to accept responsibility for any more Biharis. And so Bindran Wallace and his followers were operating a profitable sideline, smuggling them across the border. Two young Sikhs, Prabal Singh and Lalit Singh, who had gone to the Golden Temple to celebrate Guru Arjan Singh's martyrdom, were not released when the army entered. An elder from their village wrote to the Sikh president of India, Zal Singh, about their experience. In his letter, the elder, Sajjan Singh Majin Puri, said, In his letter, the elder Sajjan Singh Majin Puri said, the young men and some other pilgrims were staying in room number 61. The army searched all the rooms of the surround. Nothing objectionable was found in their room, nor did the army find anything objectionable on their person. The army locked up 60 pilgrims in that room and shut not only the door, but the window also. Electric supply was discontinued. The night between June 5th and June 6th was Beautiful. The locked-in young men felt very thirsty after some time, and loudly knocked on the door from inside to ask the army men in duty for water. They got abusive in return for their water. The door was not open. Feeling suffocated and extremely thirsty, the men inside began to faint and otherwise suffer untold misery. The door of the room was opened at 8 a.m. By this time, 55 out of 60 had died. The remaining 5 were also semi-dead. The 5 survivors of that night of horror were arrested by the army and taken away to interrogation. Sula Ranjit Singh, her husband, and the children in there. 2 months later, 3 of the children that Randhir Kaur had been looking after were released after a well-known social worker had filed a petition in the Supreme Court in Delhi. Randhir Kaur was released at the end of August. She rejoined the 3 children who had been released, but no one could tell her what had happened to the other 9. Speaking later of the battle of the hostel conflict, Major General Brass said, "The terms of reference given to me, as far as this time was concerned, were to take them to battle only if forced to do so, to protect the maximum number of lives and to ensure that all innocent people came out alive. I'm glad to say that by isolating this area from the main conflict, we were able to achieve that aim. That claim is not allowed by eyewitness account."